All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show. Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and welcome back to Making the Argument. We've got a great episode for you today. We're going to lay out some tools, some processes to where you can debate anybody about anything. That's right, for the low, low price of absolutely nothing, since it's not like we charge for this podcast, we're going to equip you to be able to engage in debate, discussion, argumentation in a way that's effective, that doesn't require you to be an expert in every single field that you could possibly find yourself in a conversation in. And I get asked about this a lot, right? People, you know, how do you memorize these facts and figures, or how do you, you know, debate one minute it's gun policy, and the next minute it's economic policy, and then immigration policy? Well, the good news is that it's not like you have to be a subject matter expert in everything. There's no possible way to be a subject matter expert in everything. But with the glories of critical thinking, you can usually identify where someone is going with a particular argument, and you can identify things like logical fallacies or flaws within their thinking that it will allow you to be able to engage in a good discussion with somebody without, again, having to have a PhD in every particular topic out there. So we're going to lay out, you know, what's needed to be able to do that. What's needed to be able to go into any situation and to have an intelligent and productive conversation, right? This is not a tool to just destroy all of your political opponents whenever you get into an argument. It's more about how do you foster that good dialogue in order to come to rational and reasonable conclusions. All right, so let's get started. First thing that you have to know, right, and there's no getting around this, is just the basic understanding of how critical thinking works, right? What are the laws of logic? Now, right off the bat, you'll have some people that even challenge the laws of logic, but, you know, we'll explain a little bit later how that doesn't really work, right? So let's start with the laws of logic, or at least the laws of logic that pretty much everyone agrees on, right? So the first law is the law of identity, right? That is, something is what it is and it's not what it's not. And that sounds obvious, but obviously with everything going on in political discourse nowadays, that's not always taken for granted. But to make it really simple, a duck is a duck because it has all the characteristics that make it a duck, right? That's the DNA that it possesses. It's those features which are uniquely duck in nature, right? So that's all it is. A is the mathematical equation for the law of identity, all right? Something is what it is, and it is not the opposite of what it is, or something different, or something that doesn't share the same characteristics, all right? The next law of logic we'll discuss is the law of non-contradiction, which is to say that something cannot be simultaneously true and false in the same sense and in the same way, okay? So if something is a duck, well, then it is not a pig. Right. Again, this seems really obvious, right? But the law of non-contradiction is one that people try to refute or claim doesn't exist, or they just flat out ignore it, right? But the law of non-contradiction is important. The moment you make an argument where you are contradicting yourself or your propositions are contradicting themselves, the argument is invalid, right? There's something wrong there. And then finally, the third law is what we call the law of the excluded middle, which is to say that a proposition is either correct or it's incorrect, right? Or the conclusions you come to are correct or incorrect. There's not some magical middle ground where, okay, something can be both true and false in the same way and in the same sense and at the same time, right? That's the law of the excluded middle. Just think of it as the, you know, you don't get out of the laws of logic, you know, rules just because they're not convenient to your argument, right? So law of identity, law of non-contradiction,
law of the excluded middle. Now, some people will also include what they call the law of rational inference, which is to say that, you know, a certain amount of evidence or observations, you can come to other conclusions based off of the preponderance of evidence or things like that. And this also breaks it down into two other categories of what we call like syllogisms, but essentially it's methods of making an argument or a statement. And that's deduction and induction. All right, so deduction, one of the most common examples of deduction is proposition A, if all people are mortal, and proposition B, and Aristotle is a person, then proposition C is Aristotle is mortal, right? So that's your, you've got your two subjects, and if both of those subjects are true, then the third one has to be true, right? If all people are mortal and Aristotle is a person, then Aristotle is mortal, right? That's deductive reasoning. And what deductive reasoning is allows you to come to a certain amount of certainty about your overall conclusion, right? That's what deduction is. Induction is a little bit different. That's more of like the preponderance of evidence leads to a conclusion that is highly probable. So for instance, if every morning you wake up to go to work, you put your key in the ignition and you turn the ignition and your car turns on, well, using the inductive principle, we can conclude that if tomorrow you get into your car and turn the key in the ignition, your car will also turn on. Now, it's not guaranteed your car will turn on, right? There could be some things going wrong with it or whatnot, but the overwhelming, you know, group of evidence suggests that provided that you do the same thing that you did the day before with under the same circumstances, you'll have a similar result. All right, so that's the difference between deduction and induction, right? Deduction is we've deduced something down to its only logical conclusion. Induction is we've argued up to the most likely or most probable outcome as a result of something, right? And again, I'm sure there's some people that will come in and say, well, no, that's not the specific textbook. That's generally what it is, okay? So again, just to recap real quick before we get into this next segment where we, again, teach you how to effectively debate with anyone, critical thinking, laws of logic, law of identity, law of non-contradiction, law of the excluded middle, right? Generally two forms on how we discuss topics or come to valid conclusions. That is the deductive method or the inductive method, okay? And you'll see a lot of people that obviously engage in what we call logical fallacies, right? And logical fallacies can either be something where the structure of your argument is wrong or the propositions that you propose don't actually lead to a logical conclusion, right? And so like an example of a logical fallacy might be something like an ad hominem attack, right? Or what they call attacking the person instead of the argument. So for instance, if someone comes up and says, hey, here's all the reasons why alcoholism is bad. And the person responds to that person and says, well, you're a drunk. Who are you to talk about it? Right. Well, that's an ad hominem attack. You're not actually looking at the reasoning they put together for their proposition, which is that alcoholism is bad. You're just attacking them and suggesting that because of some sort of character flaw within them, then their argument is now flawed as a result. That's an ad hominem attack. Another one you see very commonly within political discourse is a straw man argument. That's where someone creates kind of like a weak version of your argument and then knocks it down. You see this a lot in interviews. There's a really good interview with Jordan Peterson where he would say something and then the interviewer would say, so what you're saying is this, and she would say something completely wrong or opposite or not at all in line with what Jordan Peterson actually said. So she's essentially creating a straw man, which she then knocks down because she's not able to actually engage with the debate or the proposition that he made. Right, so those are just a couple examples of logical fallacies and how people run afoul of again, good critical thinking and logical argumentation. And we'll probably dedicate an episode one of these days to just specifically going through some of the most common logical fallacies, giving examples of them, and then talking about how to combat them and re-engage. But today, we're going to talk about a method I like to call the presuppositional method, all right? And anybody that's familiar with like Christian apologetics, will be familiar with the idea of a presuppositional method. Another method is called evidentiary apologetics. And so to kind of sum it up, in an evidentiary method, what it is you're presenting evidence in order to say that, okay, based off of this evidence, there's now a high degree of probability. So it's a lot like the inductive method, okay? within presuppositional, what you're doing is you're looking at the underlying assumptions behind someone's argument. And let me give you an idea of kind of how this works. Sometimes people will come to you and they'll just start spouting out facts or figures or statistics in order to justify a particular position they have. So maybe it's the minimum wage, right? And they're talking about the number of people that are making minimum wage or the number of people that are trying to raise a family on minimum wage. Or maybe they're talking about how impossible it is to meet all the goals for all of that. And so therefore, we should raise the minimum wage, right? Now, you can attempt to go through and counter all the facts and figures that they're spouting at you, right? You can look at how many people within the labor market are actually on minimum wage. You can actually talk about what the true intention is with somebody in an entry-level position. You can do all of those things and you can respond with your own facts and figures, right? But if you don't have them readily handy, all right, that doesn't mean that you have to disengage from the argument. One of the most effective things that you can do right there is ask questions. So in a presuppositional approach, you would actually ask a question to open them up within their own underlying assumptions. So it may be absolutely true that a certain number of people are making minimum wage and have been making minimum wage for years. It may be absolutely true that it is very, very difficult to raise a family of four or a family of five on a minimum wage salary, okay? But none of those assumptions or none of those figures or facts leads automatically to the conclusion that raising the minimum wage is a good idea. And so rather than trying to immediately come back and attack the facts and figures, you come back and you ask a question like, you know, that's really interesting. You know, you talk about all these people on minimum wage. How many people are on minimum wage for an extended period of time? How many people within the labor force are actually on the minimum wage? Is the minimum wage or is an entry-level job really intended to support a family of four, right? These are all questions that get them to come back and start to look at, okay, yeah, these facts and figures are correct, but do they properly yield to the conclusion that I'm offering? Another thing that you do is you start to ask about the conclusion itself. So if your conclusion is that we should raise the minimum wage in order to help people on minimum wage, you ask a question of, okay, well, why is someone making minimum wage in the first place? Why do these entry-level jobs exist? If you do raise the minimum wage, what will happen to those entry-level jobs, right? If you force an employer to pay more, are they more likely to hire additional people or are they more likely to potentially fire people? Is it reasonable to assume that if you artificially increase the cost of labor, that you're going to necessarily increase the cost of the goods and services which are produced by that labor and then cause prices to go up? So you'll notice that in every single one of those questions I asked, we're getting to the underlying assumptions, but I'm not throwing out a bunch of facts and figures. I'm just asking questions. And a lot of times that process of asking questions, again, about the underlying assumptions or about whether or not the desired end state will be achieved by what they're proposing, doesn't require me to automatically know what the department or what the minimum the number of people in the minimum wage are from the Department of, you know, Bureau of Labor and Statistics. Doesn't require me to know that. I'm just asking a question. The other thing that it does is it fosters dialogue, because now someone doesn't necessarily feel that you're attacking them or you're saying that they're an idiot or that they're wrong or how stupid could you be. You're getting them to come back and provide answers to your questions. And again, you're challenging them within their assumptions or within their own presuppositions. And so that a lot of times that helps foster a good conversation. So that's one of the things I would encourage you to do is when you look at an argument, and especially when someone is throwing out a bunch of statistics or again, figures, or they're citing experts, don't get intimidated. You know, ask more questions. Okay, well, why does that expert believe that? Or did that expert have anything to say about X or Y? That will keep the conversation going in a way that, you know, doesn't put you at a complete disadvantage simply because you didn't show up being able to cite all the figures at the same time. And I want to give a couple examples of how this works. So for instance, in the General Assembly session, there was a delegate that got up and claimed that competition, we were talking about education policy. And what she said was that competition produces winners and losers. And that's not the sort of environment we want for our children, right? So I want you to think about that argument real quick because there's a superficial plausibility to it, right? Competition produces winners and losers. Okay, is that true? Yeah, that is generally true that when two entities are competing over something, whether it be in business or whether it be in a sporting event, one's going to win and one's going to lose. I mean, theoretically, you can have a tie or you can have some sort of equilibrium, but winners and losers is generally what happens within a competitive environment, okay? And then her next proposition was essentially, because competition creates winners and losers, that's not the sort of environment we want for our kids. Because again, when we think about education for our kids, do we really want to think about a system where, well, the only way that some kids can have a great education is if other kids fail or if other kids lose? No, none of us want that. So again, the way that she worded this was actually pretty clever, because there's superficial plausibility in two areas, right? The first area is the nature of competition, that there's winners and losers. The second area was in what we all want for our children, right? We don't want our children to be in an environment where we feel like, again, only some can win and only some can lose, right? But now let's look at the underlying assumptions of what she was saying. So she said, in a competitive environment, there's winners and losers. That's true. Let's just acknowledge that that's true. Here's my question. In a non-competitive environment, can there also be winners and losers? Well, of course there can be. Of course there can be winners and losers in a non-competitive environment, depending on what we're talking about. So for instance, in the environment she's talking about, where the government essentially has something of a monopoly over certain types of education, the winners in that, theoretically, are the people that benefit from the monopoly. So if you've got a job or if you're a part of the monopoly, you benefit because now other people are not allowed to compete with you, right? So that's the winner. Who's the loser? Well, the loser is everybody that would like to also engage in providing that product or that service, in this case, education, but now they're excluded from the process, or they're excluded from receiving the money that the government allocates for this process. So it's not as that in a competitive environment, there's winners and losers, but in this monopolistic environment, they're not. No, there's winners and losers in both environments, right? So that's the first flaw in the overall reasoning taking place here. That in a government-controlled monopoly, or when the government's controlling the system, that people don't lose. Here's another thing that's really interesting to look like. And this kind of goes to that second point of that, yeah, we don't want a system where we feel like one kid's got to win in order for the other, or one kid's got to lose in order for the other kid to win. She was talking about competition almost exclusively from the perspective of service providers. So yes, in a competitive environment, whether it be in business or whether it be in education or anything else, there will be certain service providers that do a better job and therefore will benefit or will do better from a service provider that doesn't do as good a job. Right, so there's the A-B correspondence here, right? You have two service providers. They're competing to see which one can do the best job with respect to providing an educational environment or opportunity. But there's a third component that she is leaving out when she makes this argument. The third component is the customer. The primary beneficiary from competition are not the two service providers that are competing with one another in order to provide the service. The primary beneficiary is the customer that now has options and now has the ability to choose. Because ultimately, if the customer is the one deciding which service provider wins, then the customer always wins in that environment. But if the government's the one deciding within a monopolistic environment, if the government's the one deciding who wins, well, the only person that potentially wins is whoever the government has favored. The customer now doesn't have an option. The customer is provided with what the government tells them you're going to get, and that's it. And if it doesn't work for that customer, well, too bad. Well, now who's the loser in that scenario? Right? So the whole reason why we have competitive markets is not because we're trying to make it really easy or great for the competing parties when it comes to producing the products or the services. It's because we want the customers to benefit from having options. And then ultimately, the service providers also benefit from this, and here's how. So even in a competitive environment where you have a winner or a loser in a particular competitive bout, both sides can actually benefit from that as well. The person that was providing the service or the product more effectively or more efficiently, and the way we know it, they did it more effectively or efficiently, is because the customer voluntarily chose their product or service over someone else's. They now benefit. This is our way of, as customers, of telling that person, you're doing a good job. You have found a way to use scarce resources, scarce time, in order to provide something that I want. And so I want you to do more of it, right? That is good for the provider that is using resources efficiently to meet customers' demands, right? What does it mean for the person that loses out? Well, It might mean that they learned something from the exchange, right? You've heard this said a lot, especially in sports, that a lot of times you learn more from your defeats than you do from your victories. Well, that one service provider might say, you know what? That's a really good model. Instead of competing with that model, I want to be a part of it. And so now that person still has a job. It's just now they've adopted a better model and more customers are able to be served because now there's more people producing that service. Another way they might do is they might say, you know what? I'm not very competitive with that service provider in this particular field, but I think I can be more competitive in this environment, which is an underserved area. And so now they go off with the new knowledge that they have, having lost that one interaction, and the next interaction they engage in, they're actually better off and they're more prepared in order to appeal to customers in order to provide them what they really want or what they really need, right? So again, if you look at that, it's not like I rattled off a bunch of facts or figures or statistics suggesting why a competitive marketplace for education is better than a monopolistic marketplace. We simply challenge the assumption that was being made about the nature of competition, about the nature on how customers interact with competitive service providers, and which system logically produces better results based off of which system is more responsive to customers and which one gives them options. And here's the interesting part is that a lot of times in government, you'll hear people on the left say that, well, the more important it is, the more government control it needs to have. I would argue that in many cases, it's exactly the opposite. Education being a perfect example of this. You know, we have forced millions of children into a non-competitive educational environment where service providers do not feel like they have to compete for that child or those parents' patronage. Because the government's the one deciding who wins and loses. Well, the government isn't the one receiving the education. Why is this third party deciding for the customer what a good education looks like? Wouldn't it be better if we allowed that marketplace of ideas? Because here's the other thing you would find, especially in a service as diverse as education, is that instead of pushing them all into a one-size-fits-all approach, having a diverse array of responses and opportunities for children's education would allow them to be able to cater to the specific needs of individual children or groups of children. But you're not going to get that in a government-controlled or a monopolistic model, right? So again, that's just one way that you can look at an argument. You can open it up with the underlying assumptions or presuppositions, and you can challenge it to determine whether or not it actually produces the correct results or whether or not the argument is truly valid once it's been held up to an ample amount of scrutiny, right? So again, just a presuppositional approach and challenging the underlying assumptions. Let's take another example. We had a delegate that got up and said that in the United States, white people comprise about 60% of the population, but they hold about 80% of the wealth. And then he went on to say that black people comprise about 13% of the population, but only control about 4% of the wealth. And then he went on to suggest or infer that this is a direct result of previous racism. It's a direct result of policies which encourage inequity and inequality within America, and that it was, you know, obligatory on us as legislators to change the law and to provide different incentives or motivations in order to get rid of that inequity. Okay, so that's his underlying supposition, right? Is that the fact that one group of people controls less wealth than their overall representation in the population automatically means that that population has been put at a competitive disadvantage by the law, like, or there's racist motivations behind that. Okay, so again, how do we look at this? Right? I'm not going to question his figures, right? I don't have the figures at hand right now, so I don't know. But I don't really need to in order to get at some of the problem at the conclusions he's coming to. Because really, he's only given us a couple of data points. He said that this particular group represents this much and they control this much wealth. This particular group represents this much, they control this much wealth. Since it's less than what he thinks it should be, therefore, it's a result of bad or racist policies or whatever it is. All right. Now, we could go the facts and figures route here. We could. Like for instance, we could look at the Asian population within the United States, because the Asian population actually controls a larger percentage of wealth than you might expect from their population, right? So right off the bat, that questions this whole narrative that is racism or is unjust laws the only way to explain a particular disparity, right? But here's another example I like to use. Michael Jordan is far wealthier than I am. There is a huge inequity between Michael Jordan's net worth and my net worth. Okay, does that automatically mean that Michael Jordan was the beneficiary of policies that were racist toward me? No, of course not. Right? But if those are the only two data points we're using, then I can make the same argument that this delegate made. I can say that, well, look, this person is a different ethnicity than I am. This person makes more money than I am. This person's more famous than I am. Therefore, I must have been denied something. Right? Well, no, that's obviously not true, because we know enough about me. We know enough about Michael Jordan to know that there's other factors here. For instance, Michael Jordan is phenomenal at playing basketball. I am not so phenomenal at playing basketball. Nobody would pay me to play basketball. I would not pay to watch me play basketball, but I will certainly pay to watch Michael Jordan play basketball. And here's the great part. The inequity in our net worth is not a result of injustice. It's a result of different talents, abilities, work ethic, and choices. And not to mention the fact that Michael Jordan, I'm sure that making a lot of money playing professional basketball was a motivation, but it probably wasn't even the primary motivation. I think he has a genuine love for the game, and he has an ability and a talent, and he wanted to be able to use that ability and talent in a way that would benefit him, but would also benefit his fans and the sport itself. I have different talents, and I like to use those talents in such a way that also allow me to be able to provide for my family, but also give me purpose and meaning with respect to the actual labor or the endeavor itself. And so I could have chosen a different field. Now, I never would have been able to compete against Michael Jordan in basketball, but I could have picked a different field that would have allowed me or put me in a more competitive position to make more money or make as much money as Michael Jordan. The difference was, is I didn't have a desire. I didn't have a desire to go to become a brain surgeon, or I didn't have a desire to go, you know, try my luck at Hollywood and potentially make millions of dollars being an actor. I didn't have a desire to go within the financial markets and become, you know, a hedge fund manager and potentially make billions of dollars that way. I didn't have that desire. I had a desire to serve in the military, and then I had a desire to do the things that I'm doing right now. And it doesn't pay me nearly as much as what Michael Jordan gets paid, but that's not a result of inequity, right? And that is the fundamental problem with the argument that the delegate was making as it was presented. Now, I'm sure, you know, given the opportunity, he would like to provide additional facts, figures, and reasoning for why he came to that conclusion. But the problem was, is that he really didn't within that environment. He just offered two simple data points. And he said that because an inequity exists, therefore an injustice exists. All right, well, inequity is not automatically a result of injustice. Some inequity is, right? And that's the question that you ask, right? So when somebody presents to you, well, hey, this percentage of the population only controls this much wealth, this percentage only controls this much wealth, therefore an injustice has taken place, right? The underlying assumption you want to challenge is to say, well, is that the only thing that could explain the disparity? Is that the only thing that could explain the inequity in the data that you've brought up? Because the answer to that question is absolutely not. In fact, the Brookings Institute, which is more of a left-leaning think tank, came out a while back with a study that essentially said that in order to not live in poverty in the United States, there's three things that you have to do, right? Graduate high school, get a job, keep a job, and, you know, wait to have kids until you're in a position where you're financially stable and you can take care of them and raise them in a stable environment, right? If you do those three things, regardless of where you start off in life, regardless of your sex, regardless of your ethnicity, you will not live in poverty in the United States. You will move up the economic ladder. Now, how far you move up it or how fast you move up it is going to include a whole host of other decisions. How many hours do you want to work a week? What sort of field do you want to go into? Is that field competitive? Right? Does that field have a high demand on the services within the marketplace? Do customers really like it or have a high demand for it, which is going to yield to you getting paid more? Right? All of those things affect the decision with respect to how much wealth you're going to control that has little or nothing to do with your race or your sex or even your starting point in life. So again, what's the underlying assumption behind his argument? Underlying assumption is that inequity equals injustice. And all you have to do in this case is point out that inequity can be a result of a whole host of factors. And some of those factors may be unjust, right? Obviously, Jim Crow laws in the United States put Black Americans at a competitive disadvantage with other races. That is horribly wrong and deserved to be, you know, protested, lambasted, and removed from the law, right? But there's a whole host of other decisions that can also affect disparities. Everything from geography to how you were raised. And you see this argument a lot too in privilege. So you'll hear have someone say that, well, if you grew up in a two-parent home that was loving and stable and reasonably wealthy, then you have a lot of advantages that are not conveyed to somebody that doesn't grow up in a similar home. That may be accurate, but what are you suggesting from that? Are you suggesting that we punish the person that whose parents did all the right things? Are you suggesting that we punish the parents who set their child up for success? Or should we have an environment that encourages parents to do the right thing, to make good decisions, not only for how it'll benefit them, but for how it'll benefit their children in the future? Right? It's that whole question of what sort of, not sort of just what intent you have, but what sort of incentive structure are you creating? Right? But again, the thing that you'll notice in each one of these approaches is that the primary method of engagement is asking questions about the underlying assumptions in order to open someone up within their own presuppositions. And I'm telling you, it works. It works really well. I can't tell you how many times I've been in a debate where I've been trying to, you know, figure out a really pithy response, and then I see someone provide the sort of presuppositional response I've just offered and think, oh my gosh, it's so simple. I'll give you another example. You know, one of our favorite authors that we've mentioned on the podcast before, Theodore Dalrymple. He was reviewing a case where a person had gone before a judge and they were essentially arguing for financial benefits because they were saying that they had been exposed to carbon monoxide and the exposure to carbon monoxide put them in a position where they weren't able to concentrate. And a psychologist backed this up. They weren't able to concentrate, and so therefore they weren't able to hold down a job. Therefore, it was now the state's responsibility to provide for them. And I'm sitting here thinking about, okay, well, this is an interesting case. How would you respond to this? How would you look at the scientific data to determine whether or not this person was exposed to carbon monoxide? How did it affect them long term? And I'm thinking about all the different ways on how I'd like to get into this data and really look at it. And Theodore Dalrymple said, the thing that amazed me is that every question this judge had, the person claiming that they couldn't concentrate had an immediate, well-thought-out response. I mean, it was painfully obvious by the testimony the person was giving that they did have the ability to concentrate, work hard, research data, come up with a coherent argument, and provide responses when it was required of them. And yet they just went with the psychologist saying, well, yeah, they were exposed. This is a potential second effect. They can't concentrate, and so there you go. Right. But again, if they would have just looked at what was right in front of them and said, well, wait a second, your behavior right now is challenging the very argument that you're making. Right. And so that's why this method is so effective. Right. Because again, it doesn't require you to be a subject matter expert in everything. It just requires you to use good critical thinking. And before you get into responding to, you know, a proposed solution, go back and look at the underlying assumption, at the proposition that has been laid, and see, is that a good proposition? Is the evidence that has been presented sufficient to justify the conclusion that they've come to? Because if it's not, that's where you want to start the argument. Because I'm telling you right now, when it comes to statistics, when it comes to facts, when it comes to, you can prove anything you want. It's all a question of what data you include and what data you exclude. It's all a matter of, once I've decided what data I'm going to include or exclude, what conclusions am I then going to infer from them? And have I followed a logical thought process with respect to my inference? Or have I just cherry-picked the statistics in order to arrive at the conclusion I want? Or am I picking my statistics not because it rationally follows to the conclusion I have? Am I picking my statistics solely so I can then make an emotional argument that makes you feel bad if you oppose what I'm saying? That's incredibly common. That's also referred to as an appeal to emotion argument, which again is something that we'll get on a later episode. But again, these are just some of the things I wanted to, you know, break down, provide some examples. So as you're engaging with people, don't get intimidated. Right? If you're talking about a subject matter that you haven't done a lot of research on, but something doesn't quite sound right, right? Take a step back. Don't automatically assume their conclusion and start asking them more about their proposition. Start asking them more about what led them to the conclusion that they have. Is there another way that we can look at it? Is there another perspective? Is there additional data that could actually help us come to a more valid or logical conclusion? right? This will foster the conversation in a productive way, right? And allow you to be able to effectively engage in debate with just about anyone on just about anything. All right, so once again, I want to thank you for joining us on Making the Argument today. Also, I want to do a shameless plug for another venture that we're involved in called the Why Minutes. So in the Why Minutes, we talk about a lot of principles governing a free society and human interaction. We have a lot of really interesting stories. We did one on Tunnel 57, which was the most successful tunnel escape in the history of the Berlin Wall. We did another episode on why rent prices are so high. And we share some interesting stories in order to illustrate these principles. So I encourage you to go to thewhyminutes.com, take a look, give us your feedback on that. Also, leave us your comments. And as I always say, we need you to like and share this podcast. So if you like the content, if you think it has a value for yourself, if you think friends would be interested, go on to that Apple Podcast or Spotify, or if you're on YouTube, give us a like, share it with somebody, write us a review. We would really help it. It's the currency of this sort of business. So once again, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Making the Argument.
once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.